Chapter 13. Dressed only in his surgical robes, Apothecary Fabius loomed over the operating slab where his subject lay and nodded to the apothecarian servitors. They lifted the chirurgeon device so that it slotted neatly into the interface unit mounted at his waist and plugged in the connectors that meshed his own senses with the workings of the chirurgeon. In effect, the device would give him multiple independent arms that would all work in concert with his own thoughts, responding to his needs far quicker and more skillfully than any orderly or nurse could ever hope to. In any case, the surgery he was about to perform was best kept from the eyes of those who might balk at what he must do for it to succeed.
"Are you comfortable, my lord?" asked Fabius.
"Never mind about my comfort, damn you," snapped Eidolon, clearly ill at ease and feeling vulnerable on the surgical table. The Lord Commander was stripped out of his armour and fatigues, lying naked upon the cold metal slab as he prepared to go under the apothecary's knife. Hissing, gurgling machines surrounded him, and the flesh of his neck and throat was covered in counterseptic gel. A cold blue fluorescence bathed his skin in a dead light, and the glass jars around the apothecarium were filled with all manner of abominable fleshy growths, the purpose of which defied understanding.
"Very well," nodded Fabius. "I take it you have spoken to the captains under your command regarding their volunteering for augmentative surgery?"
"I have," confirmed Eidolon. "I expect most of them to report to you within the next few weeks."
"Excellent," hissed Fabius. "I have such things to offer them."
"Never mind about them," said Eidolon, the powerful soporifics rendering his voice quiet and a little slurred. Fabius checked the machine, monitoring the speed of the Lord Commander's metabolism, and adjusted the flow of drugs into his system, mixing the composition with some chemicals of his own devising. Eidolon's eyes darted nervously over to the spiking lines on the monitor's screen, and Fabius could see a light sheen of sweat on his subject's brow.
"I am sensing a certain reluctance on your part to relax, my lord," said Fabius, the cold light gleaming from the multiple scalpel blades he held poised above Eidolon.
Eidolon's face twisted in anger.
"Are you surprised, apothecary? You're about to cut my throat open and implant an organ the purpose of which you still haven't told me."
"It is a modified tracheal implant that will bond with your vocal cords and should allow you to produce a nerve-paralyzing shriek similar to that employed by certain warrior breeds of the lair."
"You're implanting me with Xenos organs?" asked Eidolon, horrified.
"Not as such," said Fabius, with a toothy grin. "Though there are strands taken from the alien genome I chose to mesh with Astartes gene seed, mutated under control conditions. Essentially, I will be adding a new organ to your makeup, one that you will be able to trigger at will in battle."
"No," cried Eidolon. "I do not wish this, not if it requires Xenos filth to be implanted in me."
Fabius shook his head.
"I'm afraid it is too late to back out now, my lord. Fulgrim has authorized my work, and you demanded that I work on you upon your return. What was it you wanted? Oh, yes, to be my greatest success, faster, stronger, and more deadly than ever before."
"Not like this, apothecary," shouted Eidolon. "Cease what you are doing now."
"I can't do that, Eidolon," said Fabius matter-of-factly. "The soporifics are rendering you immobile, and the samples I am to implant will not survive if they are not grafted to a host body. Why struggle? You'll feel so much better when I'm finished."
"I will kill you," snapped Eidolon.
Fabius smiled as he saw the Lord Commander attempt to free himself. Such efforts were wasted, for the drugs being pumped around his system and the metal restraints held him fast to the table.
"No, Eidolon," said Fabius, "you won't kill me, for I will deliver on my promise to you. You will be more deadly than ever before. You should also remember that a warrior's life is a dangerous life, and that you will be under my knife many more times before this crusade reaches its climax. So do you really want to threaten me? Let the drugs take you. And when you wake, you will be the model for how our beloved Legion is to take the next evolutionary leap forward.
Fabius smiled, and the scalpels descended. Even before they reached the ruin on the other side of the valley, Solomon could tell that it was not a ruin after all, its structure intact and showing no signs of having been part of a larger building. However, having no better idea of what the unusual structure was, Solomon decided that ruin was as good a word for it as any. Shaped like the upper half of a bowstave, the curving structure reached to around 12 metres in height, its base set into an oval platform formed from the same smooth, porcelain-like substance as the ruin itself. The arch it described was graceful and alien, though it displayed none of the disturbingly excessive qualities of the lair architecture. In fact, thought Solomon, it was beautiful in its own way. Once again the Astartes spread out to surround their leaders as they approached the alien ruin. Solomon felt a curious apprehension of the sight of the structure, for it did not look like a building that had been abandoned for millennia. For one thing, its surface was unblemished by so much as a single stain, moss or weathering, and the smooth stones that dotted its surface gleamed as though freshly polished. "What is it?" asked Marius. "I don't know," replied Solomon. "A marker, perhaps?" "A marker? For what?" "A boundary, maybe," suggested Sortavitz to general nods. "But between whom?" Solomon turned to see what Fulgrim made of it, and was shocked to see tears running down his Primarch's face. Julius stood next to the Primarch, his own face also streaked with tears. He looked around to see what his fellow captains made of this, seeing that they were similarly stunned to see such a sight. "My lord," said Solomon, is something the matter?" Fulgrim shook his head and said,
"No, my son, do not be alarmed, for I do not weep out of pain or anguish, but for beauty."
"For beauty?"
"Yes. For beauty," said Fulgrim,
turning and extending his arms to encompass the wondrous landscape around them.
"This world is incomparable to anything we have thus far seen in our travels, is it not? Where else have we seen marvels laid out before us with such perfection? Nothing of this world is wanting, and, were such things possible, I would believe that such a place could not come about by accident."
Solomon followed his Primarch's gaze, seeing the same natural marvels laid out before him, but unable to feel as moved as his commander. Julius nodded in time with Fulgrim's words, but of the four captains present, he alone appeared to have been affected in the same manner as the Primarch. Perhaps Marius had been correct to insist on the wearing of helmets, for surely there must be some undetected agent within the planet's atmosphere that had affected them so. But any agent capable of affecting a Primarch would have long since affected him.
"My lord, perhaps we should return to the pride of the Emperor," he suggested.
"In time," nodded Fulgrim. "I wish to remain a little longer, for we shall not return here. We will enter the planet in our records and move on, leaving it untouched, for to despoil a place such as this would be a crime."
"My lord," said Solomon, "move on?"
"Indeed, my son," smiled Fulgrim. "We shall take our leave of this place and never return."
"But you have already designated this world as 28-4, Solomon pointed out. "It is a world of the Emperor, and is subject to imperial laws given to us by him to uphold without equivocation.
To abandon it without leaving armed forces to impose compliance and defend it against enemies is contrary to our mission amongst the stars."
Fulgrim rounded on Solomon and said, "I know our mission, Captain Demeter. You should not presume that I do not."
"No, my lord, but the fact remains that to leave this world unoccupied would be contrary to the word of the Emperor."
"And you have spoken with the Emperor on this," snapped Fulgrim, and Solomon felt his objections withering under the intensity of the Primarch's gaze. "You claim to know his will better than one of his sons. I stood with the Emperor and Horus on the surface of Altenaeum as its inhabitants destroyed the planet's ice caps and flooded their world beneath the oceans to destroy natural beauty that had taken billions of years to form, rather than allow us to take it from them. The Emperor told me that we must not make such mistakes again, for the galaxy will be worthless if we win it as a wasteland."
"The Lord Fulgrim is correct," said Julius. "We should leave this place."
Solomon felt his resolve harden in the face of Julius's support of the Primarch, for he heard the tone of the sycophant in his friend's words.
"I agree with Captain Demeter," added Saul Tarbitz, and Solomon had never been so glad to hear another's voice. "A planet's beauty should have no bearing on whether or not we render it compliant."
"Whether you agree or not is irrelevant," growled Marius. "Lord Fulgrim has spoken, and we must obey his will. That is our chain of command."
Julius nodded. But Solomon couldn't believe how easily they were going along with what was tantamount to disobeying the word of the Emperor. Over the course of the next 2 weeks, the 28th expedition came upon another 5 worlds of a similar nature to 28-4. But each time the fleet moved on, without claiming it in the name of the Emperor. Solomon Demeter's frustration grew daily at the expedition's apparent unwillingness to enforce the Emperor's will upon these empty worlds, and no one other than he and Saul Tarbitz appeared to find it unusual to find such paradisiacal worlds unoccupied. Indeed, the longer the expedition spent in the Perdus region, the greater Solomon's conviction became that these worlds had not been abandoned, but were in fact awaiting their inhabitants. He had no facts upon which to base this supposition, save a feeling that the worlds they had seen thus far were too perfect, as though they had been deliberately fashioned rather than allowed to develop on a natural path. He spoke less and less to Julius over the course of their travels through the Perdus region, the captain of the first spending much of his time either in the archive chambers or with the Primarch. Marius appeared to have earned back his favour in the eyes of Fulgrim, for more and more it was the warriors of the first and third who accompanied him to the surface of each newly discovered world. Saul Tarbitz had become a newfound ally, and Solomon had spent a great deal of time in the training halls with him. The man believed himself to be a line officer through and through, but Solomon could see the seed of greatness within him, even if he could not. Throughout their training sessions, he would encourage him to see his potential and stoke the fires of his ambition. Saul Tarbitz could be a great leader of men, given the chance, but Eidolon was his lord commander, and it was for him to say whether Tarbitz would advance beyond his current station. Solomon had dispatched numerous communications to Eidolon on Tarbitz's behalf, but thus far the lord commander had replied to none of his messages. After the fourth world had been passed by without an imperial presence dispatched or a planetary governor put in place, Solomon had sought out Lord Commander Vespasian. They had met in the Gallery of Swords, a mighty processional hallway where marble likenesses of long-dead heroes of the Legion looked down upon their successors. The gallery formed part of the central spine of the Andronius, a strike cruiser that Fulgrim favoured as his second flagship, and was a place where a warrior could find solitude and inspiration from the presence of the dead heroes of his legion. Vespasian stood before the graven image of Lord Commander Ilios, a warrior who had fought with Fulgrim against rival tribes of Chemos, and who helped in the transformation of their home from a hellish world of death and misery to one of culture and learning. The two warriors clasped hands, and Solomon said, "It is good to see a friendly face." Vespasian nodded and said, "You've been making waves, my friend." "I've been honest," countered Solomon. "Not always the best way these days," said Vespasian. "What do you mean?" "You know what I mean," said Vespasian. "So let us not fence with words, but simply share the truth. Eh?"
"Suits me," said Solomon. "I never did have much time for fancy words."
"Then I will speak plainly, and believe that you are a warrior I can trust, for I fear that something terrible has happened to our legion. It has become decadent and arrogant."
Solomon nodded and said,
"I agree.
There's a new superiority come over the legion. It's a word I've heard from too many throats not to notice. I've already heard some of what happened on murder from Saul Tarvitz, and if what he tells me is even half true, then we are already earning enmity among the other legions for our high-handedness."
"Do you have any idea what might have begun this?"
Solomon shrugged.
"I'm not sure, but it was after the Laren campaign that things changed."
"Yes," agreed Vespasian,
turning and walking along the length of the gallery and passing a grand staircase that led to one of the ship's apothecarians.
"I believe that to be the case, though I do not know what could have engendered such a dramatic transformation."
"I've heard a lot of talk about the temple Lord Fulgrim captured," said Solomon. "Perhaps there was something inside that affected those who entered, some sickness or weapon that altered their minds. What if the lair had some unknown power in that temple, some collective corruption in their consciousness that was passed to the Legion?"
"That sounds far-fetched to me, Solomon."
"Well, maybe it is, and maybe it isn't, but have you seen the renovations Lord Fulgrim has ordered to be carried out in La Fenice?"
"No."
"Well, I never saw the inside of the Lair Temple, but from what I've heard, it sounds as though La Fenice is being turned into a replica of it."
"Why would Lord Fulgrim replicate an alien temple on board the Pride of the Emperor?"
"Why don't you ask him?" said Solomon. "You are a Lord Commander. It is your right to speak to Fulgrim."
"I will indeed, Solomon, though I still don't understand what relevance the Lair Temple has."
"Perhaps that it's a temple is what's relevant."
Vespasian looked sceptical.
"Are you suggesting that the power of their gods somehow affected our warriors? I won't suffer any talk of unclean spirits in this place of heroes."
"No," said Solomon hurriedly, "not gods as such, but we know that there are foul things that can pour through the gates of the Empyrean from the warp, do we not? Perhaps the temple was a place where such things could more easily pass between worlds. What if the power that filled the lair came with us when we left?"
The two warriors stared at one another for long seconds before Vespasian said,
"If you are right, then what can we do about it?"
"I don't know," admitted Solomon. "You should talk to Lord Fulgrim."
"I will try to," replied Vespasian.
"What will you do?"
Solomon chuckled and said,
"Stand firm and act with honour in all things."
"That isn't much of a plan."
"It's all I have," said Solomon.
Serena D'Angelus watched with amazement as the work on La Fenice continued with wondrous speed and boundless creativity. Colours leapt off the walls, and music that felt as though it knew her very heart filled the once drab and seedy theatre. Artists of all description had worked on the decor, and the splendour all but took her breath away. To be surrounded by such an embarrassment of talent made her realise just how much she still had to work on her own paintings, and how worthless her pathetic skills were. The mighty portraits of the Lord Fulgrim and Lucius still sat mockingly unfinished in her studio, both canvases torturing her with their incompleteness.
To have beings of such wondrous, unimaginable beauty sitting before her, and yet be unable to blend the precise tones she needed, had driven her to fresh heights of self-loathing and mutilation. The flesh of her arms and legs was scarred with cuts from a sharpened palette knife, her blood mixing with her paints to enrich the colours. But it hadn't been enough. Each droplet of blood held its vibrancy for only a short time, and Serena's mind had filled with dark terrors of what would befall her if she didn't finish her work, or if it was ridiculed for being found wanting, or somehow lacking in sensation. She closed her eyes as she tried to picture the light and colour that had filled the temple on the floating atoll. But the memory flitted beyond her, elusive and forever out of sight. Her blood had enhanced the colours of her paints, and she had turned to ever more esoteric fluids and substances of her own flesh to improve it yet further. Her tears rendered her whites luminous, her blood the reds to fire, while her waist gave her shades of deep darkness she had not previously imagined possible. Each colour had awakened new sensations and passions she had until now been unaware of. That such things would have repulsed her only a few months previously never entered her head, for her all-consuming passion was in reaching the next high, the next level of sensation, for as each one was experienced it was soon forgotten, like an ephemeral dream. Weeping with frustration, Serena had smashed yet another painting, the crack of timber, the tear of the canvas, and the pain of the jarring impact giving her a moment's pleasure, but even that had faded within seconds. She had nothing more to give. Her flesh was spent and had exhausted the limit of sensation it could give, but even as the realization came to her, so too did the solution. Serena made her way through La Fenice towards the bar area, which, though it was late, was still home to a great many remembrances, without the wit to retire for the night. She recognised a few souls, but avoided them, seeking out one who would be least likely to object to her attentions. Serena ran a hand through her long hair, unkempt compared to its normal shine, but she had at least brushed it and tied it back in an effort to look halfway presentable. Her eyes scanned the patrons of the bar, smiling as she saw Leopold Cadmus sitting alone in a booth, nursing a bottle of dark spirit. She made her way through the bar towards his table and slid into the booth next to him. He looked up suspiciously, but brightened up as he saw a woman joining him. Serena had worn her most revealing dress and a low pendant that drew the eye to her breasts. Leopold did not disappoint her, his red-rimmed eyes immediately darting to her cleavage.
"Hello, Leopold," she said. "My name's Serena D'Angelus."
"I know," said Leopold. "You're Delafour's friend."
"That's right," she said brightly. "But let's not talk about him. Let's talk about you."
"Me?" he asked. "Why?"
"Because I've read some of your poetry," she said.
"Oh," said Leopold, suddenly crestfallen. "Well, if you've come to be a critic, save your breath. I don't have the energy for another bloody review."
"I'm not a critic," she said, placing her hand over his. "I liked it."
"Really?"
"Really."
His eyes lit up, and his expression changed from that of a mean-spirited drunk to one of pathetic desperation, where suspicion is suddenly ousted at the faint hope of praise.
"I'd like you to read some to me," she said.
He took a drink from the bottle and said, "I don't have any of my books with me, but..."
"That's all right," interrupted Serena. "I have one in my studio."
"You like to work in a mess," said Leopold, wrinkling his nose at the aroma that filled her studio. "How do you find anything?"
He ambled around the edges of her workspace, warily stepping over discarded pots of paint and smashed pieces of timber and canvas.
He examined the few pictures that still hung on the wall with a critical eye, though she could tell that the images there meant nothing to him.
"I imagine all artistic types work in such disarray," said Serena. "Don't you?"
"Me? No," replied Leopold. "I work in a small cubicle with a data slate and a stylus that only works half the time. Only the important remembrances get to work in studios."
She heard the bitterness in his voice, and it thrilled her. The blood was singing in her skull, and she had to fight to control her breathing. She poured a deep red liquid into a pair of glasses from a bottle she had obtained from a sutler on the lower decks of the ship for just this occasion.
"I suppose I am lucky," she said, picking her way through the detritus of her work. "Although I know I really should do something about this mess, I hadn't known I was going to have company tonight, but when I saw you in La Fenice, I knew I just had to talk to you."
He smiled at the flattery and took the offered glass, looking inquisitively at the viscous liquid within it.
I hadn't expected anyone to want to hear my work," he said. "I was only able to come out to the 28th Expedition when the shuttle carrying the poet selected from the Melican Hive crashed."
"Don't be foolish," said Serena, raising her glass. "A toast."
"What are we drinking to?"
"To a fortuitous crash," smiled Serena, "without which we might never have met." Leopold nodded and took a cautious mouthful of his drink, smiling in return as he found the taste to his liking.
"What is this?" he asked.
"It's called Mama Juana," explained Serena. "It's a mix of rum, red wine, and honey combined with the soaked bark of the Uricoma tree."
"Exotic," said Leopold.
"They say it's a powerful aphrodisiac," she purred, draining her glass in one long swallow and hurling it across the room.
He jumped as the glass shattered, leaving a red stain on the wall as the dregs of the liquid dribbled down. Emboldened by the directness of her desire, Leopold drained his own glass and dropped it to the floor with the nervous laugh of one who cannot believe his luck. Serena leaned forwards and wrapped her arms around his neck, pulling him in for a passionate kiss. He was stiff in her arms for a moment, startled by the sudden move, but slowly relaxed into the kiss. He put his hands on her hip as she eased herself into the curve of his body. They stood locked together for as long as she could bear it before she dragged him to the floor, where she tore at his clothes in a frenzy, scattering paint and overturning her easels. The sensation of Leopold's hands on her body was repulsive, but even that made her want to cry with pleasure. At one point he broke the kiss, blood dripping from his lip where she had bitten it, a look of bemused concern plastered across his idiot features. She pulled him tight to her body and rolled on top of him as they coupled like wild animals in the wreckage of her studio. At last his eyes widened and his hips spasmed. She reached down to the floor to snatch up her sharpened palette knife.
"What?"
was all he managed before she slashed the blade across his throat. His blood sprayed in an arcing jet as he thrashed in his death throes. Sticky red fluid covered her as Leopold convulsed, and this time she laughed at the wash of sensation that flooded her body. He gurgled beneath her as his life blood pumped out of him, and his hands clawed at her in desperation. Blood pooled in a vast lake beneath Leopold, and Serena stabbed her knife into his neck again and again. His struggles grew weaker and weaker, while her pleasure heightened to an explosive climax. Serena remained on top of Leopold's body until his convulsions ceased and his flailing arms fell to the floor. She rolled away, her flesh heaving and a heart thudding against the inside of her chest in a wild drumbeat. She heard a last rattle of breath escape his ruined throat and smiled to herself as she smelled his bowels and bladder voiding in death. Serena lay still for some moments, savouring the sensation of the kill,
and taking pleasure in the thunder of her blood and the warmth within her. What wonders might she work upon the canvas with such materials? On the 30th day after the 28th expedition's arrival in the Perdus region, a great many of the questions that had arisen following the discovery of the uninhabited paradise worlds were finally answered. Travelling in the vanguard of the expedition, the Proudheart was the first to pick up signs of the intruders. Word flashed back to the fleet, and within moments every ship was at battle readiness, gunports unmasked and torpedoes loaded into their tubes. The alien vessel made no overtly hostile moves, and the pride of the Emperor surged forward to join the Proudheart over the objections of Captain Lemuel Eisel. At last, the flagship of the Emperor's children detected the presence of the enemy vessel, though its surveyor officers fought to keep the signal constant, for it kept fading in and out of the display. Repeated hails were met with walls of static, though the fleet's astropaths reported a curious deadening of their warp vision, similar to that which had long shielded the region from the sight of navigators and telepaths. At last, the forward elements of the fleet came into visual range of the lone vessel, and it appeared on screen as a faint, slightly blurred outline. Its true size was impossible to determine with any accuracy, but ship logisters estimated its length at between 9 and 14 kilometres. A vast triangular slice curved above the hull like a billowing sail, and even as the image resolved in the centre of the viewing bay, a voice sounded over the ship's vox system, crystal clear and speaking in perfect Imperial Gothic.
"My name is Eldrad Ulthran," said the voice. "In the name of Craftworld Ulthwe, I bid you welcome."